Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. And I think you're going to find our subject matter today interesting. We all are concerned about environment. We want to be conscientious individuals relative to doing our part to making this world a healthier and better place. We've come to understand that a lot of habits or patternings that we have had relative to industrial development, medical development, so many other areas, that we've created some situations that we just didn't have the capacity to really understand or see. Well, my guest today, Lisa Bennett, she and two colleagues, Daniel Goleman and Zenobia Barlow, both of whom, along with Lisa, are just incredibly dedicated people to trying to make a difference and working with young people to do so. The book is Eco-Literate. This is a book about how educators are mindfully cultivating emotional, social, and ecological intelligence. It's a different way of thinking. Lisa, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's nice to be with you.
Well, Lisa, you are the communications director for the Center for Eco-Literacy. You've been for many, many, many years very deeply involved in understanding or trying to understand how we can make a difference in the environment. Daniel is an international, well, he's internationally known as a psychologist. He's written a book called Emotional Intelligence. He is a former New York Times science reporter. Zenobia Barlow is the executive director and co-founder of the Center for Eco-Literacy. And also being very much involved in this, how did this trio, we could call you the three musketeers for eco-literacy, how did you manage to come together to form this alliance for educating people about the importance of being involved?
Well, it was very interesting. We first met in 2009. And Zenobia and I are both with the Center for Eco-Literacy, and at that time we had another book coming out called Smart by Nature. And we reached out to Daniel asking if he would consider writing a foreword to that book, and which he agreed to do. And he also became curious about us because ecological intelligence was becoming much more of an interest for him. And he was fascinated with the idea of how do we really teach this in schools. So he came to our office and we met, and it was a fascinating conversation because it was as if we'd each discovered a missing puzzle piece in each other.
Mm-hmm.
His work on emotional and social intelligence had influenced the work that we've done at the Center for Eco-Literacy for a long time. And, you know, he in turn had a great interest in supporting education for sustainable living. So we had this idea that, you know, sharing a common language and a common goal, we could come together and create something that would illustrate, you know, what happens when you integrate emotional, social, and ecological intelligence in education and the great benefits that presents to education today.
Well, there is such a diversity of material in your book, Eco-Literacy, that I think is incredibly valuable. But I'm going to quote from your book here, and this is from the introduction, that schools must not educate to one narrow notion of intelligence, but to eight forms of intelligence. Bodily, kinesthetic, interpersonal, verbal, linguistic, logical, mathematical, intrapersonal, visual, spatial, musical, and most recently, naturalistic. I find it so fascinating that in our time frame, we are using terminologies that to the Native American centuries ago, they would have said, what's the big deal? We just do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to chuckle because there is this intellectual component that is being brought in with this, when actually this should be something that should be as normal as breathing. Why do you think we've evolved to this level where there's such a detachment from the natural rhythm of life?
It's a wonderful question, and you know, I do have to say that the indigenous cultures have been a tremendous inspiration in the work that we have done from the beginning, and like you, recognize that there was a lot of understanding there before we have attempted to come up with new ways to explain what has in fact long been known. But I do think that every time has to, rediscover certain truths in their own new language and framework. And, we happen to be in one that used to conceive of intelligence in a very narrow way. And over the past several decades, especially since Howard Gardner's work on multiple intelligences, we're seeing how there are many different kinds and, not one right way. And I think that in this particular work, what we found of tremendous benefit, to education and really to people in general, is just the idea of connecting these intelligences, integrating them more. And the stories that we tell in the book, for instance, some about educators and students, some about community activists and leaders, they show people who are really making a difference by having all of those intelligences, manifest in them, and awareness of their own emotions, an ability to develop relationships successfully with others, and understanding of our connection to the natural world. And when you bring it all together, it's really an antidote to, I think, a lot of the hopelessness that we see out there when people just get kind of overwhelmed by the number of challenges that are facing us today.
Well, and I think every generation has challenges to face. There was a program recently on the development of the Industrial Revolution in the United States. And the thinking regarding the Industrial Revolution, which was so positive on so many levels, but on other levels, it created a big void because the most of the population at the time was not educated. Many of them were not literate, so a lot of the jobs that they had disappeared. And things changed very quickly and very rapidly, which is actually going on in our world today. So to look at the situations that occurred in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and what's evolved since, and here we are today where we have such a technologically advanced positioning in so many ways, and there's such a distorted detachment from what I call the real world. And we've just had a natural disaster that has hit New York, New Jersey, and areas of the East Coast, just absolutely showing us that it doesn't take much for all of our technology to be thrown back into an environment where it's just survival level. It can happen very, very quickly. And that puts you into an awareness level where you go, how do I work with this environment? What do I do with this environment? And so many people are so detached from that. And your stories, I'd like to start off with the very first section. It's called Lessons from a Coal Miner's Daughter. And you talk about mountaintop mining. In fact, this is an issue that actually is coming to the forefront in certain parts of the United States. And this was a group of statistics that I found quite interesting. An estimated 500 mountaintops, 1 million acres of forest, and 2,000 miles of streams have been destroyed since the mid-1980s. In 2010, a team of researchers found higher rates of hospitalizations and deaths due to heart, lung, and kidney problems in mountaintop mining regions than elsewhere in the United States. Now, just that little segment has a big, big shock aspect to it. Tell us the story of how the coal miner's daughter made a difference.
Well, you know, I think what I heard you say throughout all of that also, if I can just speak to it, is that sense of removal that, you know, that we have from understanding the connections in this mm-hmm. increasingly complex society. And, you know, that's to no one's fault, really, the way we look at it. It, you know, but it is a consequence of the Industrial Revolution, and it makes us need to have different ways of understanding what the consequences of the actions of our society are. And one of the key ways that we see is in, you know, helping people, you know, see the connections, develop some empathy, develop a sense of caring. So how do you do that? In the case of the coal miner's daughter, this is a story about a woman from Kentucky named Terry Blanton, who is, you know, maybe about 20 years ago, she was living in eastern Kentucky, which is, you know, a fairly poor part of the state. And she was a coal miner's daughter. She was a coal miner's sister. She worked for a coal company for a while. She just grew up with it and really didn't think twice until she went out, you know, and sent her kids off to school, and they'd have to run down the hill to catch the school bus on a road that the coal trucks also passed. And they, you know, when these coal trucks passed, they would stir up dust, and then the coal dust would get mixed in with the rainwater, and it would make this coal sludge. And that was right where the kids were standing and waiting for the school bus. So they complained to her one day and said, you know, Mom, our shoes are dirty before we even get to school from this. So she went down and she took a look, and she was pretty disgusted that her young children had to stand in this coal muck. And so she called up the local highway authorities and started to complain about it. And the next thing she knew, there was a big, big coal truck that started driving around her home. She lived in a motor home, and it would just circle her home all day in a pretty, you know, apparent attempt to intimidate her for complaining. And she called them back up, and she had another conversation with them, and in the process she said, you know, if you think you're going to intimidate me, you have another thing coming. And she just accessed that fight in her and started working with other community members and started, you know, staying really focused on doing what she thought was the right thing, and that is making sure her kids could get to school without being exposed to all of this. And she was successful in getting another road built. She then teamed up with a group of women in the community and found that, in fact, the water there had been polluted for many years. It was declared a Superfund site. And, you know, the EPA came in and agreed to clean it up. And one thing really led to another there, because it was a very, you know, significant problem. And I think, you know, and that was 20-odd years ago, and she's still at it today. I had an occasion to meet with her in the governor's office in Kentucky when she and others, including the writer Wendell Berry, went to the governor's office and decided they were just going to stay there all day until they could talk to him and say, you know, this isn't right. You cannot benefit coal companies over people and the planet. And there was a very quiet, persistent, patient, you know, ability to be together, to stand up for what they thought was the right thing. And they're still doing it. And, you know, when we look at something like that, we can see that there are a lot of lessons to be gained there. She clearly demonstrated, you know, the development of emotional intelligence over the years, because she was in a lot of situations that could make her very, very angry, and did make her angry, but she learned how to manage that, you know? She learned how to work with other people as a reflection of social intelligence, and she had a clear understanding of the connections between the ecological impacts that happen from this mountaintop mining, where, you know, the mountaintops are blown up and the rubble is pushed into the streams below and pollute the waterways.
Mm-hmm. See, I think so much of this, and one of the recurring themes that is throughout the book, is don't have temper tantrums. You don't need to go around carrying billy clubs. It is a process of education and understanding. And just as we have created what is perceived as a negative, there can be the creation of being able to do this. Mining is going to be necessary. That is not going to stop. There are so many products and services, these different materials are needed. But doing it in a way that is going to be with conscience, with thoughtfulness. Anybody that runs a company, if they do not pay attention to the fact that if they are poisoning the water, they are poisoning the earth around them, if they don't have a bigger plan of what they could do with it or how they can contain this, so everything around them is going to stay healthy, then this is something they're going to have to deal with. But it's a mentality. It is a thinking process. It is thinking differently. And then in your book, you go into another aspect of education that your chapter is titled Beyond Whining, Kids Rethinking New Orleans School. And I just thought, this is incredibly good stuff. We hear so much about the bad. We hear so much about people that are lazy, incompetent, not responsible. And there are a lot who are. And we often underestimate the capacity of kids. And they're so articulate that they themselves like to be little thinking boxes, depending on their age. And you have in this chapter the information about how before Katrina hit, we all know about Katrina and the devastation. These are some stats that are just absolutely mind-boggling. Two-thirds of New Orleans schools were failing and chronically under-enrolled. Some of the schools are so old and neglected that school board members said they should be condemned. Nearly three-quarters of eighth graders lacked proficiency in math or English, which is appalling. The school system itself had a reputation for fraud, incompetence, and corruption. So here is a storm that is so massive that it literally gives the opportunity for a restarting and a rebuilding of something that was just an utter mess. And the kids were involved in this. This is terrific. Tell us about these kids. I love it.
It is terrific. And, you know, half of the stories in this book are of kids who, in collaboration with their very creative educators, are doing fantastic stuff. And, you know, so often these issues are presented in kind of a dull, you know, or depressing way, or you know, kids find education to not be relevant to their real lives. You know, they don't find it to be engaging. Well, in this kind of education, what we're seeing kids do is just fantastic. And in the case of New Orleans, they're, you know, they're called the Rethinkers, and they were brought together under the guidance of this wonderful woman, Jane Woolley. And she had the insight that as New Orleans was at that moment that you described, where, you know, their schools were wiped out and they needed to rebuild it in order to rebuild them, in order to rebuild the community, that kids had important insights to bring to that discussion. And so she organized them to, you know, to study some of the issues and to think up solutions. And that phrase, beyond whining, you know, came from her, because she said, you know, nobody's going to listen to you if you whine. You have to be focused on coming up with some positive solutions.
Oh, so, and I think some of their solutions were terrific. One of the points with an evaluation that was done, and I think this is significant, because this is coming from the kids. 62% of the students on average felt that the teachers that had been teaching them before, they wanted to know that the teachers really wanted them to learn. And I thought, this is something. Here you've got a total reverse. kids saying, I really want to know my teachers are there for me. Also, mm-hmm. the kids set up something, a mood detector. Instead of metal detectors for weapons, they were saying, let's have a detection system on what kind of mood is a person in. And the students themselves had a chill-out zone and a resolution circle. I thought, holy Joseph, this is great stuff.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's, you know, the energy that you feel when young people, and these were middle schoolers and high schoolers largely, you know, when they can come together and be part of the process and part of the solution, is just tremendously inspiring. And, you know, one of the most common criticisms that we hear about education today that comes from young people is that they just feel like it's not relevant. You know, they come home and they're bored and you know, how does this affect my life and all of this. And what we're attempting to show in this book is that there, you know, there is another model of education that makes it very relevant and very engaging, and you know let them loose with some of the stuff with the proper guidance, and they come up with ideas that, you know, we adults very likely might not come up with.
And I think that's wonderful. You want children to think about being problem solvers. That's what leadership comes from. And you want them to know that they will be respected for their ideas, but you also need to give them the chance to test things out, to get their hands dirty, to be out in the field. And that leads into a section that you've got on restoration to resilience. From restoration to resilience. And I really like this. I know in the Pacific Northwest, in Oregon and Washington, that there are many different environments that do this with kids, and the kids love it. They go out, it can be raining, it can be snowing, it doesn't make any difference, but they are engaged and maybe working and cleaning up an environment, but they get their hands dirty. They get out there. And you mention an organization in the book called STRAW. It's been around for like 20 years plus. More than 230,000 students have restored nearly 21 miles of habitat in California's Marin and Sonoma counties. I think this is incredibly important. You need to be able to get, you need to be able to touch, smell, feel, understand the involvement, the ecosystem, how a bug feeds a frog, and the frog feeds a bird, and the bird goes, you know, with something else. I mean, there's this tremendously complex ecosystem that we're a part of. And when the kids can be involved, and they then can develop a respect so that they won't brutalize animals. And I have nothing but kudos to give to people that are out there doing this, because it makes a big difference. Kids don't have that anymore. Years ago, there was enough space to do it. They could go out and check out the butterflies or the spiders or the worms, this type of thing. But in today's world, we've become so antiseptic. And again, I'll use the word you used before, detached. So this is really, really great. And the fact that the kids are so involved in this, they're understanding certain things because it's preparing them for the world that they're going to be moving into. Cultivating eco-literate learning communities. How would we go about that?
Well, this book we really designed to be of interest to everybody, we hope, you know, because it's about an important model of education, but also because we want to provide educators with the tools for how to integrate this education. You know, the book provides stories for inspiration of how people are doing it, but we also want to provide some of the professional development tips for educators who can do it. And, you know, there are a number of strategies that we talk about, and, you know, to form a learning circle and to have structured conversations and to design collaboratively and so on. And, you know, one of the things that we know from a lot of research is that many people recognize as one of the most important qualities that students need to develop in order to be successful in the world is the ability to be collaborative problem solvers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this kind of education is very focused on developing that kind of collaboration, you know, working.
I think that is so significant. And one of the tools relative to that is the talking stick. And I can remember the first time I really, this was not all that long ago, it was last year, there was a particular group of women that got together, and I had been invited to be a guest, and they used the talking stick. And it was wonderful to see this in operation, and I've been aware of it, but it was the first time I'd ever experienced it. And it really is something that families could even incorporate in the conversations instead of having people yell at a table. So many times when you have a large family or there's people, I want to say something. If you have the talking stick and mom or dad say, you have the talking stick. Nobody else can talk and you're given so much time. This is the stick. It passes to you. And everybody has to respect that. What a wonderful discipline that is.
Yes, and, you know, to go back to what you said earlier in the conversation about the, you know, the wisdom of indigenous cultures and the recognition that, you know, of how important the community is and the community relationships, and that's very much at the heart of what we do at the Center for Eco-Literacy. In fact, one of our core practices is the one that states sustainability as a community practice. We recognize sustainability as a community practice. You know, we can't do this alone. Solving any of these problems must happen in community. And if you even look at it a little more deeply than that, you know, we see that if you want the best possible model for sustainable living, you look to nature, and because nature has sustained life for so very long, and you know there is our model, there is our idea that, you know, nature is our teacher, and the way nature sustains life is in community. You know, it's in the nature of the relationships. So that's very much to the heart of what we're talking about here.
And I think that it's so important to be able to keep one's mind and understandings open so that we don't become adversarial. And I think that that is an old, old model that goes back for centuries that has been perpetuated. You look at so many different types of programming, it's the dog-eat-dog attitude. Well, I understand that. But in this world today, we have a much different positioning. And the dog-eat-dog positioning typically created a lot of the dilemma that we have today, because that kind of an attitude creates fear and it creates isolation. So we have to re-educate ourselves. And I think your book, Eco-Literacy, goes a long way to creating the seeds for thought that enables people, and I would say even myself, to become aware of certain things and to say, all right, what can I do as an individual? I don't try to change the world. I just change my world. I just do the best I can with what I've got. How can I interact with others? And if I'm going to be around children, how can I support them so that they're going to be able to grow into a world that is going to be sustainable and beautiful and offer opportunities for expansion that you and I may not be able to experience, but they need to be able to look forward to. And, of course, they need to be able to enjoy good health, abundant food, clean water, the things that we supposedly take for granted that we cannot take for granted. And that's what your book, Eco-Literate, goes into detail about. And it's such an enjoyable read, an informative read, that I think anybody would really have some positive things to include in their own thought processes by the time they finish it. Lisa Bennett, you have a website called ecoliteracy.org. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
Ecoliteracy.org. And people can go there, find out more about your organization. I was just delighted with this material. In fact, when I got the book, I thought, what is this going to be, a political something? Far removed. Far removed from that. And that was so refreshing. Because
thank you.
There's so many agendas out there, and so much of the agenda is so uninformed. And your book goes a long way to giving different thoughts, different positionings, not saying this is the only way, but saying, think about these things. What else can we come up with? And I love the support of the kids and the fact that there are those that are working with them to say, let's look at this because we have to be the problem solvers. Mm-hmm. So that sort of eliminates a generation gap, too. Lisa, it's been a pleasure having you as a guest. For those of you listening, you might want to check out the website, ecoliteracy.org, and I think it will give you something to really say, I can make a difference. It's a real good thing to do. Donna Sebo here, again, my guest. Lisa Bennett, Ecoliterate is the book, ecoliteracy.org, the website. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number to call into, if you would like to do that, is 888-627-6008. That's right. Phone lines are open, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 888-627-6008. I do need to let you know, tomorrow we may not have I know my guest isn't going to be able to make it, but I also don't know if I'm going to have a surprise guest. I absolutely don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's going to be one of those Fridays, but I do know the phone lines will be open for the entire hour, so you can let your friends know. Also, I wanted to let you know about the guests that are coming up in the following week. My goodness, these days go by just so fast. We are going to be talking, let me correct myself. I do have an author we're going to be talking with about Heaven's Child. Caroline Floor is going to be my guest. She will be with me for a short period of time. And we are going to be talking about Heaven's Child. And this is about how you can reach people that have some mental disability problems. But we are going to be discussing not only that, but we're going to be going to the San Juan Islands and beyond. Karen King. I met Karen about a month ago, and she has the most wonderful stories about orcas. So her book is all this gorgeous, gorgeous photography. And, of course, this is located all up here in the Pacific Northwest where the orcas migrate through. So we're going to be talking about orcas and then blue sky, white cloud. Eliezer Sobel is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking with William Sullivan next week about cabin fever. This is the real-life experiences of someone that decided they were going to go back to the real world of the survivalists. Well, we're going to hear about that. Empowering Yourself, Blanca De La Rosa. This book is dynamic. This is a woman who is from the South American area of the world, and she broke through her own glass ceiling, culturally, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally. Her story is wonderful. And then, of course, well, Thanksgiving. Yes, that's a holiday, so we'll have a Best of Donna on that day. And then we are going to be talking about lost decency, Atta Agahanawal. Now, this story is a phenomenal story about Afghanistan. This is an incredible story. And when I received the material, I was just absolutely amazed because I learned things about a culture I knew nothing about. So we're going to be sharing some of that with you. Got a great lineup for next week. Can you believe that Thanksgiving is just around the corner? Hi! How did you get here so fast? I'll tell you, it just seems like I blinked, and this year has just whizzed on by. I wanted to share a thought with you about Thanksgiving. Its leaves fall like blessings on Thanksgiving Day. Cool winds kiss my cheek as I walk on my way to spend time with my loved ones and friends. Yes, that's what it's all about. I think we need to be in an attitude of Thanksgiving frequently, don't you? So many times we get so stressed. I think we need to give ourselves a walking stick and maybe just do it on our own to say, I give myself this time to express my gratefulness for the many blessings that I have in my life. And I think so many times we forget to do that, and we need to do it more often. Donna Sebo here. I'm going to be sharing with you a story about a forensic pathologist who had a near-death experience. Quite an interesting story. But before I do that, I wanted to share a little bit of unique information. Yes, I know. I pull these little tidbits out from all kinds of sources. But I have a photo in front of me of a woman who is called the Lightning Lady. Now, I would no more want to have had her experiences than a man in the moon. The fact that she's even alive today is amazing. But this lady is 84 years plus. She was born and raised in Somerset, England. This woman has been struck no less than four times. And she first was hit by electricity in 1980 when she was having a cup of tea in a hotel. The second time she got hit with electricity was 22 years later when she was at a friend's funeral. The third time was when she was walking down a street near her home 6 months later. And the fourth, while she was lying in bed in December 2004. Do you know what? She was never seriously injured by any of these energy strikes, lightning strikes. But she's become allergic to electricity. Can you imagine that? Being allergic to electricity in these times? Oh my goodness. And she experiences a lot of pain if she gets too close to any kind of electrical appliances. And I just, I am just astonished. She's healthy otherwise. Over 84 years of age. And surviving these odd, weird attacks. Amazing stories about people's experiences. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. I wanted to share this story with you about a forensic pathologist. There are so many people that have had near-death experiences, but this is a woman who was trained in the medical profession. She's very, very logical. She's very practical. She said, as a doctor, I thought of death as a biological phenomenon. And she ends up having an experience that is totally, totally unexpected, as they all are, really. She said, I am always fact-based. And whenever I was with patients who would share their stories of near-death experiences or other types of experiences, it always bothered her. She thought that gee whiz, this is just not logical. This isn't something that's real. When she'd have a patient say to her, I know that I'm going to be dying. Don't be sad, doctor, because my parents are waiting for me. Something like that. Just didn't make sense to her. Now, what happened to her was this. She and her husband had gone to the country of Chile for a whitewater kayaking vacation. Her husband is an orthopedic surgeon, and they share their practice, but they love the outdoors. They just absolutely love doing things together that take them out of doors. And White River, they just adored that. They had been on more than one White River jaunt and thoroughly enjoyed everything that they did. Well, in Chile, there was this extraordinary location, and she and her husband decided that they were going to kayak in this one area. And her husband said, you know what, I really don't think I'm going to participate in this. I'm going to take the truck and I'm going to meet you at the takeout point. He said, I really don't think I want to do this. Now, she had been having this strange feeling. She described it as a shadowy type of feeling. And she said, you know what, why don't you go along? She kept trying to encourage him. He said, no, not going to go in, not going to do this. Well, she took his life jacket, which was a bright red, and she said, this way you'll be able to spot me. And they got in, everybody got into the kayaks, and she said, one of the things is that there's a spray skirt that goes around the waist, and it can keep water out of the boat, and it'll keep the legs dry when you're kayaking. And if you get into trouble as a kayaker, all you have to do is pull the loop, or the term they like to use is pull the chute, and you escape the boat very, very quickly. It lifts you right out. Well, she got in, and then all of a sudden, she plunged 15 to 20 feet down the falls, and in hitting the water below, she lost her paddle. She smashed into submerged rocks. She was trapped underwater. She couldn't paddle. She couldn't move. She was under the pressure of a waterfall. And the current was very intense, obviously. She couldn't move. She was totally trapped. Now, her brain was working, and the brain said, pull the chute. She couldn't reach it because of the current. She couldn't connect with the loop. And she said, I can't control this. I just have to let go. She said she was thinking about her family, her four children, their practice, all kinds of thoughts were running through her head. And she said there was an instantaneous shift. She said it was a spiritual jolt. She became extremely calm. She described it like being a baby, being rocked, and being in a mom's arms. She suddenly knew everything was going to be okay. She didn't know how, but she said, my panic that I was experiencing was gone. And she just let go. Just let go. The current suddenly picked her up, took her out of the kayak. When that happened, she was thinking like a doctor because she was being battered all over the place, hitting rocks, all kinds of things. She said, your knee bones are broken. She just knew she was a pulp. She was just a bloody mess. And then something very unique happened to her. She said, I popped out of my body. Now, I'm going to share the rest of the story with you when we come back from break. This is Donna Sebo. I'm going to tell you what happened to Mary when she went out of her body. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a moment, taking a break. Stay with me. I'll tell you the rest.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you. We offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Here's the rest of the story of what happened to Dr. Mary. She'd gone over the falls, trapped, figured she was not going to make it. She does release, let go. She just said, okay, this is my time, this is my time. And then she finds herself out of her body. When she popped out of her body, she said she had this overwhelming, wonderful, encompassing cocoon of love that was around her and just permeated every cell in her body. And she said she became aware of this very, very bright light. And then she was shown her body. She was able to see her body. It had washed up on a riverbank. And she said it was a shell of an old friend. Those were her exact words. Now, her husband, being a physician, knew that she needed CPR immediately, and they were working on her, and she could hear her husband saying, breathe, Mary, breathe. And she said, I didn't want them to be sad. I thought, okay, I'll go back into my body, take a breath, but I'm going to go back to where I am, where all of this wonderful love and this beautiful brightness is. Then she did exactly that, so they kept working on her physically. She said she traveled a path that led her into a great hall, and she said it was absolutely gorgeous. There were gold bricks. She said it was amazing, and she felt her essence, she called it her soul, going towards what appeared to be just this absolutely marvelous, marvelous place. She described it as her eternal home. And she was also aware of them working on her on the riverbank. And she got very impatient because she really didn't want to go back to this former shell that she described an old friend. She really didn't want to go back into the body. However, the companions that she had with her said, you cannot stay. You cannot stay here. You've got more work to do back on Earth. She said she didn't want to go. She was ready to move on. And they said, nope, it's not your time. And she said, instantaneously, she was popped back in her body. Her eyes flew open, and obviously she recognized everybody. They said she had been dead for over 11 minutes. She couldn't move her legs. She assumed she'd broken her back. And she said it was absolutely amazing. There was one miracle after the other. One, they had to carry her up a hillside. There was an ambulance that appeared out of nowhere in this remote wilderness area in Chile. And there were helpers that assisted them. And then the ambulance and the helpers just disappeared. When they took the trip back to the United States, she said it was an amazing journey. It was like an odyssey. When she got into the U.S., she has been able to recover from her injuries totally, and she had not broken her back But she said it has taken her a long time to really absorb the experience that she had, the near-death experience. Now, this was over 13 years ago. And she said she sees how her work as a mom, a wife, and a doctor has value. And her work definitely was not over. And she said, maybe one of the most important things I have to do is to share my story, because it was given to me. I am a doctor. I think daily in terms of facts and objective knowledge. But there's a lot more to life. She said, there's another world to which we're called, and it's the most beautiful and true world we'll ever experience. She said, our eternal home awaits us. I wanted to share that story with you because I think it's a very profound one. Not only is she a lovely woman, but she is a woman that her whole positioning as a physician changed on so many levels. She realized that life is this phenomenal gift, and we have a chance to experience that gift in an absolutely wonderful, wonderful way. And that's by living each day with the greatest amount of fulfillment and joy we possibly can. Again, I'll go back to what I said earlier, counting our blessings, being present in the now. This is what makes a difference. Holiday time is coming up, and maybe you're looking for something a little bit different to serve as a vegetable. I have always loved the vegetables from the cabbage family. Brussels sprouts, the one thing that most people say about it goes, oh, yuck. One, they stink, and two, they just don't have much flavor. Well, I've got a recipe here for Brussels sprouts that I think that you will really, really enjoy, and it's easy, easy to fix. You're going to need it's Brussels sprouts with smoked ham and toasted pecans, and if you wanted to change your meat on this, you possibly could, but I'd suggest try this. I think, really think you were going to enjoy this. You're going to need 2 pounds of Brussels sprouts, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter. That's 2 pounds of Brussels sprouts, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter, 3 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, 1 large clove of garlic, finely minced, 1 slice of smoked ham, about 4 ounces. You don't need a whole bunch. 2/3 cup of chicken broth, pinch of sugar, kosher salt, a little bit of freshly ground pepper, and 1/2 cup of coarsely chopped toasted pecans. Now, your pecans you can toast easily. Just put them in a pan and let them, you know, heat up and get that wonderful aromatic smell when they're in the pan. You can do it with almonds, too. Actually, any of your raw nuts you can do this with. And it's just wonderful. Then you don't cook them too long. You can roast them in the oven if you want, but have them pre-roasted. It's going to cut your time in half. Now, this is what you do. You trim the stem end of each of your Brussels sprouts and remove any yellow or spotted leaves that might be on the outside. You want to cut the Brussels sprouts into very thin slices, about a 16th of an inch thick. And then you want to separate your slices into shreds. A food processor can do this for you so fast, it's just done in seconds. You need the coarse shredding disc attached, of course. And you put the sliced Brussels sprouts in a bowl and put them aside, because when it comes time to cook them, they're going to cook up really fast. In a big skillet, you're going to melt your butter with your olive oil over medium heat. You want to swirl it around naturally to coat the bottom of the pan. You put in your garlic. Your garlic you cook until it's soft, but you don't want to brown the garlic. You just want the garlic so it's just soft. Less than a minute. Brussels sprouts, you then toss them in. You cook them until they're bright green, barely crisp tender, under 3 minutes of time. Then you increase your heat to high. You add the ham, the broth, stir it all, cover the pan, and steam until the Brussels sprouts are crisp tender, about 2 minutes, and then season it with a little tiny bit of sugar, salt, and pepper, and transfer to your serving bowl and top it with your toasted pecans. Oh, delicious, fast, easy, and quick to fix. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, the time just goes by so fast, and I'm so delighted you were able to join me tomorrow. Well, I don't know what we're going to be doing on the show tomorrow, because my primary guest was not able to make the show. We do have one that we're going to be talking to later on in the hour, and there will be open lines. So join me. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Join me, and maybe we're going to share something with you you've just not even thought about before. This is Donna Sebo. Count your blessings. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.